I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough.
Welcome to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. On Wednesday, many of us marked a day without a woman through an international women's strike. So this week, Off Kilter has an episode without Jeremy Slevin. Don't worry, he'll be back next week. But I'm thrilled to kick off this week's episode with Michelle Chen. She's a contributing writer to The Nation and also co-host of Dissent's Belabored podcast. Michelle, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
So you wrote a piece in really covering the women's strike this week that you titled, "This is What Feminism Really Looks Like." And I want to actually borrow a quote from one of the people that you feature in the piece, a trans worker who spoke at one of the strikes and recently launched a union, spoke about the need for intersectional resistance instead of what you term establishment feminism. And this woman said in a quote that I find too good not to use, "Boss feminism is denial. It's deception. It is self-interest over solidarity." What did she mean by that? And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the end of establishment feminism as we saw in this strike.
First of all, I don't think we've seen the end of establishment feminism, but I think that is what people are sort of trying to orient themselves against, or at least, change their analysis to be more wary of that going forward. I think for a long time, the discourse around feminism has revolved around this image of feminism as it upholds a capitalist establishment. And I think what Octavia said in that quote was emblematic of a kind of grassroots feminism that is sort of returning to the original working class roots of International Working Women's Day, which was about labor, and it was about women and the dignity of labor and how those two go hand in hand. So rather than having a kind of feminism that supports, an overall patriarchy that is propped up by capitalism, or capitalism that props up patriarchy, we're now seeing intersections of different marginalized communities within the feminist movement that are more subversive, that are more willing to challenge the status quo.
One of the intersections that was on display and in droves at the women's strike this week was what you describe as the link between feminist success and racial justice. Help us understand what that looks like.
You see it on a lot of fronts, but I think that with the last administration, you saw an emerging kind of willingness to broach issues of racial and cultural difference that perhaps were kept under the lid before. With the presidency of Barack Obama, I think a lot of people had hoped that that would have been a breakthrough on race, much the same way that many establishment feminists had hoped that Hillary would have been a breakthrough when everyone expected her election this past year. And I think the first effort, of course, was successful, and we got 8 years of a Democratic presidency under Obama, at least nominally. That was a success. The second effort was not successful for various reasons. Many could say that those two subsequent events are tied together, but whether or not there was a success on the political front, I think that fundamentally people were left unsatisfied with the conversations that were happening in status quo politics, both under Obama around race and as well as under the debates surrounding the first American presidency that people have been hoping for, the first American female president that we've been hoping for. So, and I think that between those two, there was kind of a disillusionment with what establishment politics could do for working people, because over the past 8 years, one of the continual through lines has been, regardless of whether we're focusing on feminism or anti-racism in that very standard liberal Washington conversation that's going on, there is an underlying current of unrest, of poverty, and of sort of economic pain that wasn't being addressed. And I think that people got tired of, you know, the limitations of the liberal discourse. And I think that's ultimately why we couldn't have a redo of 2008, you know. We couldn't even have a redo of 2012. I think people, you know, what political capital had been gained in 2008, and that's not to discount what it really meant for a lot of people, especially in my generation, I think a lot of that goodwill had been spent by the time the 8 years were up. And yes, there was a ton of energy around people like Bernie Sanders. But again, we saw that even within liberalism, that coalition was already starting to fray. And people felt like what we often term identity politics had had come up short in terms of what it could do to unify people around issues facing everyday working people.
Well, it'll be exciting to see where the momentum goes from here. The Women's March clearly was not a one-off, as these strikes showed. And Michelle Chen, thank you so much for your coverage of these issues, particularly intersectional coverage that you do so well. And thank you so much for joining the show.
And thank you guys for continuing the conversation.
Don't go away. Next up on Off Kilter, I'm joined by Sarah McBride, National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. We'll talk about threats to the LGBT community under Trump. You're listening to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. A couple of weeks ago, the Trump administration undermined federal protections for transgender students put in place just months before by President Obama. What's next for the LGBTQ community under President Trump? Sarah McBride, press secretary at the Human Rights Campaign and the first openly trans person to address a major party convention, joins me in studio to discuss. Sarah, we miss you at CAP.
I miss you, too. It's wonderful to be back. I feel like a friend of the pod.
What I should have said is that you, and the biggest deal ever, is that you used to be at the Center for American Progress, but I didn't.
It's usually what I lead with.
It's what you lead with. Well, and it's still in your Twitter bio, which makes
Absolutely.
It real.
Absolutely. That's right. It's not real unless it's on Twitter.
And particularly in your bio, which says so much about you. So, Sarah, part of the reason that we wanted to have you on was to look back at the federal protections that were dramatically weakened a couple of weeks ago by the Trump administration for LGBT students and particularly trans students. Help us understand what happened there. And also, given that there has been so much media coverage over the past couple of weeks about what the protections did and what the Trump administration's changes did and don't do, help us understand, are those protections still in place? What's the law today?
Well, a couple weeks ago, the Trump administration took a really disgraceful action in rescinding life-saving guidance for transgender students. That was a byproduct of years of case law and work in the administration, the byproduct of districts and administrators across the country coming to the Obama administration saying, we want clarity on how we should treat transgender students with dignity and respect and how we can abide by federal law. And so in May of 2016, the Obama administration's Department of Justice and Department of Education issued this guidance. And while I think the conversation is really centered around bathrooms, this guidance was so much more. It was about whether transgender students can go to school, whether they can go to school without fear of bullying, whether they could go to school without fear of discrimination. Obviously, part of that is being able to access restrooms consistent with your gender identity, because if you can't use a restroom consistent with your gender identity, it becomes much harder to go to school. It becomes much harder to go to work. But it was also about whether a transgender student could be called by their pronoun or name, whether a teacher would have to respect a transgender student in their gender identity, whether a transgender student could participate in extracurricular activities. And so it was about so much more than bathrooms. It was really about transgender students having the dignity and respect that they deserve during the school day. Now, obviously, there's been sort of a lot of confusion about what this means for transgender young people. What it does mean is that, one, the executive branch of the federal government really has made clear that they're turning their backs on transgender students and their rights. What it doesn't change is the fact that transgender students are still protected under federal civil rights laws. Those protections weren't created because of the guidance. They were reinforced by the guidance. These protections were a byproduct of decades of case law that have evolved to interpret federal sex protections, including Title IX, to include discrimination based on gender identity or discrimination against transgender students. Those decisions, that case law, remains, regardless of whether Jeff Sessions, Betsy DeVos, or President Trump choose to enforce it through their own branch of government. The courts are still bound by that case law. Now, moving forward, though, we are going to see this issue dealt with by the highest court in the land. We have a case coming up later this month, actually. The oral arguments will occur before the Supreme Court in the case of Gavin Grimm, who was discriminated against by his school district in Virginia. And that case will, among other questions, grapple with whether Title IX and federal sex protections include gender identity.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion, and actually in the week to 2 weeks ahead, we're going to have even more discussion of the Supreme Court nominee that Trump selected, Neil Gorsuch. He's going to face confirmation hearings likely March 20th. What do we expect if he is confirmed in terms of how he will be on the court with this and other related jurisprudence?
Well, I think that the nomination of Neil Gorsuch is of great concern to the LGBTQ community. First, in his record, obviously, a lot of people know he was one of the judges that granted basically a broad religious exemption to closely held for-profit corporations in the Hobby Lobby decision, which could have far-reaching consequences for LGBTQ people and their protections from discrimination throughout the country. He's also ruled against granting health care to medically necessary health care to a transgender woman. He has some very concerning decisions in his path. And while we don't know for sure how he would rule on this case and its specific merits, his record does raise concerns. His overall judicial philosophy, his vision for America is one of legalized discrimination against a whole host of people, including potentially LGBTQ people. The current makeup of the court is also really difficult to predict. In the marriage equality decision, we had Anthony Kennedy side with the pro-equality plaintiffs in that case. But the reality is we don't know whether Anthony Kennedy is going to be in the same place on issues of gender identity. So we don't know how the current makeup of the court will fall. But I think one of the important things is that regardless of how this case comes out, this is an opportunity for us to educate the court and the country about what it means to be transgender, about the overwhelming case law that transgender people remain protected under federal civil rights law, and about what transgender people need to live and thrive. And so that's going to be a conversation that the Human Rights Campaign, that other organizations are going to be having with the country as this case moves forward.
So since you brought up education, and I want to back up for a second from thinking about the specific policies that we expect from Trump and what they will mean for LGBT folks and for trans folks in particular. And I want to back up because I think while a lot of the folks who listen to this show may be starting from a place of, yes, I believe in marriage equality, yes, I believe in civil rights protections for people, no matter their sexual orientation, gender identity, and so forth, there may be people who aren't quite sure. And I think that that's probably the case for a lot of the folks who voted for Trump. And so I want to back up and just sort of ask the question that there may be a lot of people who are interested in hearing your answer to, which is, why is it that people who are trans deserve protections? Why is that something that is just, it's different than just being, for example, gay or lesbian? What makes it a situation that deserves actual legislation and other types of protections when it comes to your daily life?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think one of the things that the public struggles with on this question of trans equality is it's difficult for people who are not transgender to wrap their minds around what it's like to be transgender. It's difficult to put yourself in the shoes of someone else, particularly when you don't have a necessarily analogous experience in your own life. With straight folks and gay rights, I think it was easier for individuals who were straight to be able to empathize with that experience. Most straight people know what it's like to love or to lust. But most cisgender folks, people who are not transgender, they don't know what it's like to have the feeling or the knowledge of a gender identity that's incongruent with what society is seeing. And so for me as a transgender person, I usually describe that experience, that knowledge of something not being right, of my gender identity not being seen and respected by society before I came out, as a constant feeling of homesickness, an unwavering ache in the pit of my stomach that only went away when I could be seen and respected and acknowledged as the person that I am. And for me, at a certain point in my life, the pain was so great that I had to come out. I think a lot of people think people transition as a matter of happiness, but for me, it wasn't to be happy. It was to feel every emotion. It was to think more clearly, to live more fully, to be seen as my whole self. It was to remove a negative, to remove a pain that was constant in my life. And so I think one of the things that's important for folks to begin to wrap their minds around is at least understanding the motivators for transitioning, which are different for everyone, but just how serious, just how deeply held this gender identity is for transgender people. Beyond that, though, transgender people face significant discrimination in this society. 1 in 4 transgender people in a survey a couple years ago reported that they had been fired from their jobs simply for being transgender. As many as 40% of homeless youth are LGBTQ, and a significant percentage of those young people are transgender. Transgender people experience high rates of homelessness, high rates of housing discrimination. They're more likely to live in poverty. And so these are basically symptoms of pretty widespread societal discrimination. And over the last 60 years of our country's history, we have made clear that one of the sacred promises of the federal government, of all governments, is to protect those who are subjected to discrimination, is to make sure that we use the full force of the federal government, of our state governments, of our local governments, to say that every person has worth and that every person should have the same opportunities, be judged on their merits and their talents and their skills, not on who they are, who they love, how they act, or what they believe. And so that is a fundamental promise of this country. It's something that with each generation we have continuously evaluated, reflected on, and expanded. And I think at this moment we're at a point in our country's history where we are finally seeing transgender people. We're recognizing that our definition of we the people should include all of us, including those of us who are transgender. And even if you don't get it, even if you have a difficult time wrapping your mind around it, the fundamental truth remains that discrimination never wears well in history. And we don't have to be able to fully wrap our minds around anyone's experience to be able to acknowledge that someone should be treated with dignity and fairness, that that person has worth, and that they deserve to be seen. And that's what we're asking for. That's what we're fighting for. And I believe that it's a message and a request that at the end of the day will win out.
One of the debates where LGBT rights and protections, and particularly trans protections, are not being mentioned maybe as much as they should is around the Affordable Care Act. It often gets forgotten that there were important protections enshrined in that law specific to people like you to ensure that you are able to access health care in all the ways that you might need to. Can you talk a little bit about what repeal of the Affordable Care Act would mean for the LGBT community and for trans folks in particular?
Well, the Affordable Care Act is probably one of the most important pieces of LGBTQ equality legislation that has ever gone through Congress. The Affordable Care Act obviously provided life-saving services for those living in poverty, for those who maybe need lower price health care options, which disproportionately include LGBTQ people. But as you mentioned, it also included a clear ban on discrimination based on sex, which gets back to our earlier conversation. And one of the things the Obama administration did about a year ago was that they interpreted that sex protection non-discrimination clause to include discrimination based on gender identity and sex stereotypes, including the stereotype that one should love a person of a different gender. And so those protections were really vital for the trans community because roughly 70 to 80% of transgender people report experiencing some sort of discrimination or mistreatment in a healthcare setting. That could include a healthcare professional refusing to touch us, a healthcare professional refusing service outright, or a whole host of other negative experiences. And so this ban on discrimination in healthcare really ensured that transgender people could be able to access life-saving care without fear of discrimination, as long as that care was impacted by the ACA. But also, more specifically, one of the most common experiences of discrimination that transgender people face is in the pursuit of transition-related care. So that's care that transgender people use in order to transition, to be able to have our gender identity seen by society. This is medically necessary care, according to the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, according to transgender people across the country, that the Obama administration said, as long as you are providing this care for other people for other reasons, which insurance companies are across the board, then you must also provide this care to transgender people. It is discrimination to provide a service to a group of to everyone and to exclude a group of people, which is what was happening. And so these protections that are included in the Affordable Care Act are incredibly important. We know that if transgender people can't access transition-related care, it has serious consequences for mental and physical health in the long term. And that was actually something that the Center for American Progress was a significant part of, including my late husband, Andrew Cray, who was a transgender man. And Andy was a leading fighter for healthcare access for transgender people. His research and his work was actually cited significantly through the regulations that the Obama administration issued under the sex protections. And I think Andy's story for me really underscores just how important the fight is around the Affordable Care Act, just how important those protections are, and just how important this fight for trans equality is in general. I met Andy working on trans equality. We began to work together at the Center for American Progress actually after we started dating. But he was diagnosed with cancer just a few months into our relationship. And I will say that while he got excellent care at each turn, we were always concerned regarding how a medical professional would respond if and when they found out that he was transgender. Would Andy be receiving subpar care simply because someone was uncomfortable with his gender identity? Dealing with cancer is already a stressful experience. To add that fear of substandard care simply because of who you are into the equation is really a debilitating addition. And while Andy eventually got a clean bill of health, a few months later, his cancer returned. It had spread. And for him, the situation was terminal. And after Andy got that news, he asked me to marry him. We married on the rooftop of our building. I think I told this story when I was on the podcast before. But after we got married, a couple days after, he passed away from cancer. And I think for me, that experience underscored that in this fight, every day matters. Andy came out when he was in college. He was supposed to have 3/4 of his life as his authentic self. And because of circumstances outside of his control, he had less than 1/4. And a lot of people have even less time than that. And it really reinforces that change cannot come fast enough, that as Dr. King said, we should feel a fierce urgency of now. And that LGBTQ people and transgender people in particular deserve and need health care. LGBTQ people need and deserve the ability to have health care that doesn't just treat cancer or doesn't just treat a broken arm, but also allows them to be affirmed in who they are and seen in who they are, particularly when we know that it's a question of medical necessity. And so the Human Rights Campaign and LGBTQ activists across the country are going to be working to make sure that the Affordable Care Act stays in place and those vital protections remain.
In the last 60 seconds or so that I have with you, before we turn the mics on, we were sort of both commiserating about the difficult time and the difficult political climate that we're enduring as people who care about the issues we've been discussing and about sort of progressive values across the board and civil rights. But you also noted we've come very far and that for you, one of the pieces of evidence of how far we've come was your invitation to speak at the DNC last year. And I mentioned that at sort of the top of this segment, but I'd love to hear from you the significance of that speech what it is that keeps you motivated and optimistic despite the dark time that many of us are feeling right now.
Well, I think there is no question that we have come an incredibly far way, particularly in the last several years. There was no question in my mind. There would have been no question in my mind when I came out that a transgender person would speak at the Democratic National Convention. It wouldn't be a question because it wouldn't happen. And that was just 5 years ago. We've seen more states provide protections to transgender people. We've seen historic progress at the federal level, some of which is being attacked by the Trump administration, some of which I think will remain. But for me, standing on stage at the Democratic National Convention was really a symbol of how far we've come. The entire arena is lit up, so you can see the entire audience when you're standing on stage. And I was standing there, and just to the right of the teleprompters, just to the right of the television cameras, was the Delaware delegation. And I'm a native of Delaware. And my parents were standing there. And so throughout the entire speech, I could see my parents. And I thought about how scared they were when I came out. I thought about all of the things they feared, rejection in every sense of the word. But here they were, just 5 years later, seeing an arena full of people affirm and respect and applaud their child's dignity. And when I got off the stage, I walked onto the convention floor and I came across an older transgender woman named Joanne. Joanne sort of looks like your quintessential grandmother, and she's just so warm. And she got up from her chair, she came over to me, she gave me a hug. And when we went into the hug, we were both smiling. And then when we parted, she was crying. And she said to me, "I can't believe I'm seeing this in my lifetime." And I thought about all of the years of pain, all of the years of struggle that she went through, all of the years of feeling invisible, followed by years of feeling like a political liability. But here she was as one of 28 openly transgender delegates, having just seen an arena full of people celebrate our lives. And I think for me, that moment is what provides me hope in these dark times. It's what provides me the knowledge that we can continue moving forward. We can continue opening hearts and changing minds. Because on that night, I saw that the progressive movement, progressives in this country, had fully and completely adopted our cause as their own and taken the trans movement and said, "You have a home here. Your fight is our fight." And I think with that alliance of allies behind us, the sky's the limit.
Sarah McBride is the National Press Secretary at the Human Rights Campaign, and I appreciate so much the cause for optimism and the uplifting words, and it's a great note to end on. Sarah, hope to have you back soon, and like I said, we miss you, but thank you for the work that you're doing.
Miss you too. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. As Trump continues to wage his war against the media, he's declared criticism of him to be fake news while naming journalists the enemy of the people. Meanwhile, getting far less attention, is a quiet war on the media taking place at the FCC. To discuss the role of the media in Trump's America and as part of the resistance, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation, joins Off Kilter. Katrina, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be with you.
So war on the media, it feels like a phrase that barely has any meaning anymore because it's getting bandied about so much in really what has become an almost unreal feeling discussion and set of coverage on how this president is behaving and in an unprecedented way towards the press. I'm curious your perspective at an outlet that isn't quite the mainstream media and in many ways was founded not to be that.
So my sense, Rebecca, is we're at a crossroads, and it has to do with politics, with culture, with economics, and it engages and touches and factors into all areas. I'm thinking of the work you're doing, but so the media collides with an administration which is intent as part of a calculated strategy to delegitimize accountability, public interest, truth-telling journalism. At a time when the news media is in pretty dire financial straits in many areas of this country, newsrooms are being hollowed out just when state houses need more scrutiny. I think that to go back, if I could, to not so, you know, back far off history, media malpractice, as I call it, fueled the election of Donald Trump. that 24/7 unfiltered coverage of those rallies, the lack of attention to serious issues in the campaign. An issue we've covered over the years, Rebecca, is the kind of obliteration of the line between news and entertainment, so that politics and political coverage is so often, not everywhere, but spectacle. And who triumphed when it was spectacle? Donald Trump. We just published a special issue on the media, Trump's War on the Media, How Journalism Can Prevail. And it grapples with the consequences of this historic failure, this epic fail of a media, which didn't elect Donald Trump, but it abetted the rise of Donald Trump. And the issue offers a roadmap to recovering journalistic integrity and independence. And we can talk more about that, but some of it, I would just say, we need more deep reporting on issues. I mean, I think what's exciting about your work, and it so syncs with the nation, is lifting up issues and voices that aren't getting enough attention in the mainstream, and policy ideas that aren't getting enough attention from political figures. I think the mainstream media is being redefined in this Trump era because it's becoming more adversarial. It's understanding that objectivity doesn't work. Truth, rigor, verifiable data, always needed. But one thing that we still miss in the, quote, mainstream, which I think the nation provides, is giving voice to those who are voiceless, a home for dissenters, for activists, coverage of movements in a real, genuine, deep way. And I think, you know, that the mainstream, and I'll stop here, continues to police the parameters of what's possible in our society and politics. What do I mean by that? Sort of tells us what's viable. And what's viable doesn't fully engage with the full range we could explore as a country if we had a politics and a media that didn't traffic in what I call the kind of politics of downsized, excluded alternatives. So I think the work we do has real synergy, Rebecca, because it's really hard, particularly where you sit, you're at the bubble of D.C., to break out of it, to keep talking to real people who are on the ground. And as we hope to and have started with what we call a resistance beat, bearing witness beat, ensuring that those who are feeling the direct, dangerous impact of Trump and Republican policies, that we cover them with humanity, with journalistic rigor, with an understanding of the importance of attention being paid to those communities.
Well, and to that end, you raise the importance of the media really dedicating or rededicating itself to covering actual issues as opposed to kind of obsessing over the sideshow and the drama, which is so easy to do, particularly in the era of clickbait being kind of the goal that it seems media so often are seeking. But you also have written extensively, and you actually referenced this just now in the resistance beat that you guys have started. You have written that media need to be focused on not just the issues, but specifically more on-the-ground reporting.
Absolutely.
That actually looks at local issues, which are so often overlooked. I would love to hear you talk a little bit about why that's important and how that connects to the resistance.
So, you know, I was just talking about what I call media malpractice. And we can't afford a repeat of that. I mean, when the three major nightly newscasts devoted barely half an hour of their combined election coverage to actual policy issues. So, yes, issues, the you know, coverage of how actual Americans get sick, suffer if their health insurance is taken away, how workers are abused if labor protections are eviscerated. But the deep reporting from the heartland and inner cities alike shouldn't be limited to coverage of the policies coming out of Washington. The importance of bringing attention to local issues, as I said earlier, it's more critical now because the gutting of local newsrooms has resulted in too many Americans who are, you know, misinformed, uninformed about what's happening in their communities. And also important, many political commentators are disconnected from ordinary citizens. So I think it's critical for journalists to get out and do on-the-ground reporting. You know, there was a story just a few weeks ago, one way that journalists might win back trust, is, you know, the journalism, too much of the journalism on cable TV, for example, is one Republican operative talking to another, you know, to a Democratic operative. Why? Well, Rebecca, you mentioned the FCC at the beginning. I mean, some of it is because, as The Nation reported as early as 1996, a lot of these newsrooms are cogs in big conglomerates. And it's cheaper to have one Democratic operative talking to another operative. But what we need is the kind of work where we get out into the country and, you know, telling the story of activists. We were talking about the resistance, telling the story of grassroots protest movements of all kinds. I mean, I like to say transpartisan. I'm not just talking about progressives, but to get a feel of, you know, why did people vote for Donald Trump? Not all of them are racists, white nationalists. What's going on in this country where there's such anger and discontent? How is it, and we did this story a few weeks ago, how is the opioid epidemic? I believe the governor of Maryland declared a state of emergency the other day because of the epidemic in his state. But, you know, it correlates in some ways with parts of this country which voted for Donald Trump. How has, quote, free trade ravaged communities? What is being done? How are people living in places where factories have shut down? What are the new jobs? What happens in coal communities where coal isn't going to come back? Not even an action president like Donald Trump's going to bring that back. But what are the alternatives? How are people thinking? So I think it's critical to be on the ground and to be in all kinds of communities. But that takes editors who understand. That takes newsrooms which are willing to pay for people to be out and not just parachute in. I mean, we have a reporter in Lordstown, Ohio. We've had someone there for 3 weeks. Wish we could have someone longer. But to really live in the community for that period, talk to people across a range of issues.
So you mentioned the FCC, and I want to come back to that, and I mentioned it in my intro because I think it's an incredibly important story that really isn't being told nearly enough. But before we come back to the FCC, I also really would love to get your thoughts on the lack of trust in the media, which Donald Trump references as often as he can, trying to highlight and really elevate himself as the person in true authoritarian style that the American people supposedly should trust instead, as he advances alternative facts. But that low level of trust in the media is actually real. And you have written that part of what we need to be addressing and what the media needs to be addressing is the fact that in many ways, many outlets, and particularly national outlets, have become a, quote, pundit class that is profoundly out of touch. How can outlets address that perception as well as that reality, and particularly in a time where in many ways they have, as you describe, evolved not to even have on-the-ground reporters anymore in a meaningful way?
Yeah, it's a very important question, and no one, I mean, if I said to you I had all the answers, you know, you should get me off the phone, but how to begin? I think, as I said earlier, first of all, too often journalists present themselves as a part, as privileged, a privileged class. Now, the media at its best is the fourth estate. It holds other branches accountable. I would make a few suggestions. One is emphasize the watchdog role. Do your job. You know, that means holding people accountable for abuses, rectifying abuses, all kinds of guys, people, government, corporate power. Think of the story, the journalist who broke the Flint story. That story helped a community understand what was at stake, what was at risk. So I think a community comes around a journalism like that. I do think the public's fed up with, you know, these endless panels, pundit on pundit, endless opining and punditry. But I think, as I said about Flint as an example, people appreciate the investigating that the best reporters can do. They appreciate reporting that, you know, shows banks or pilfering accounts. And so I think it's almost a nonpartisan mission. Follow the money. That's what journalists must do so better than ever. Represent the interest of all citizens. Again, I come back, you know, why did people vote for Trump? What's going on in parts of this country where, you know, people are angry. They don't know what their future means, their family's future. And recognizing that those voters felt angry, humiliated, or invisible, not heard. So I think that those are things. And factual authority. You know, former Senator Moynihan had a line you may have heard. Everyone has the right to their own opinion, but not to their own facts. Now, we are living in a time of alternative facts. The nation, in fact, in, I believe it was 1996, I believe, coined the term, if you can believe this, post-truth. The screenwriter, Steve Tesich, who wrote the screenplay for the film Breaking Away, used it in an article in The Nation. Webster's credits us with that. So it's easy for me to say truth. But truth is a contested term these days, so it's even tougher for the media to gain trust. But I think some of the things I said are important to beginning to regain the trust of people and doing so with, you know, deep, fearless reporting. I don't think journalists should treat, this is maybe controversial, should treat Trump as an enemy, demonize Trump. I think what you want to do is demonize, not demonize, but to look carefully at policies. For example, don't, you know, why demonize Trump about this dastardly $56 billion defense increase? Don't, I mean, there's a systemic nature to that. Democrats and Republicans have contributed to increases in defense spending, but look carefully at what the Trump administration proposes to do. I mean, cut food stamps, cut the social safety net programs, which have been the hallmark of the civilizing reforms of this country. Cut, you know, the National Endowment for the Arts or the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I mean, these are ideological issues for many Republicans, but they will hurt the very rural communities and other communities which helped elect Trump. So I think you want to look at that. The last thing I'd say is the access journalism. Too often, journalists look like they're cozying up to those in power because they believe too many that they need access to do their job. Well, the great journalists of our country, like I.F. Stone, who was the Washington correspondent for The Nation in the 30s and 40s, or, you know, others use documents or, you know, do the work, the ferreting out in the trenches, the shoe leather reporting, and that is not access journalism.
So back to the FCC, you wrote a column actually a few weeks back, and it's one of the only sets of coverage that I've seen looking at what is effectively a quiet war on net neutrality playing out at the FCC, and really with very little sunlight actually shining on it. Tell me a little bit about what is net neutrality, why is it important, and how is it at risk and being undermined as we speak.
So let me just step back and say that over the years, The Nation, particularly John Nichols, our national affairs correspondent, has done an enormous amount on the role of the FCC in media politics in this country. In fact, John and his colleague Robert McChesney's work helped create Free Press, which your listeners should check out, a great media democracy reform consumer advocacy group. But net neutrality, the principle that all internet traffic should be treated equally, that there not be a fast lane with those for more money, that there be a level playing field where good ideas can prosper no matter who or where they come from. And great former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps has argued that net neutrality is a civil rights issue. He's right. I mean, it's an open and free internet plays in our civic dialogue. The new head of the FCC, who comes out of Verizon, he was an associate general counsel at Verizon, has quite quickly started to dismantle some of the rules of the road which were put in place under the Obama administration as a result of a lot of grassroots activism. So, you know, if we begin to dismantle net neutrality and end the reclassification of the internet as a public utility, which happened in 2015, we're going to see a kind of digital inequality. The digital divide between wealthy and poorer Americas will grow. And I think, you know, the work you do, Rebecca, where, you know, low-income families have had access to broadband, discounted broadband through the FCC, now that program, the Lifeline program, is beginning to be dismantled. So it's a declaration on low-income Americans. It's a declaration on consumers. One of the things I find particularly cruel is the new FCC commissioners abandoning an effort to limit the exorbitant cost of prison phone calls that often force inmates' families to pay upward of a dollar a minute. I mean, that's just, in my mind, criminal. Some people are fighting back. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been a longtime champion of media democracy, net neutrality, media reform, Al Franken. But, it, you know, it was what I call a transpartisan people-powered movement several years ago. I mean, you had Trent Lott and Code Pink. They were working to demand an open and free Internet. They were fighting against these cross-ownership rollbacks that lead to, like, one corporation owning media in one town. So it may seem boring to some people. Agencies don't get the coverage that sexier topics do. But I recommend that people really check out what I call the other war on the media. And John Nichols had a very good companion piece. He really is someone who's followed this so carefully as part of our special issue, which I mentioned earlier.
Katrina Vandenhovel is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. Katrina, thank you so much for joining the show, and I look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I'm sorry I rattled on too much, but I care deeply about these issues.
Never too much. You. I learn something every time I hear you speak. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Back to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Everyone's talking about the GOP effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but getting far less attention is the Republican plan for Medicaid, which would set the clock back on disability rights and inclusion 50 years or more. To cut through the facts, figures, and statistics, I'm joined by three women whose lives would be turned upside down if the Republican Medicaid plan were to take effect. And I'd like to thank each of them for their willingness to share their personal stories with my listeners. First, you'll hear from Andrea, then Anastasia, and then finally Marta. Let's take a listen.
So I am a full-time wheelchair user. I was diagnosed with a physical disability when I was 2 years old, actually, and I'm 33 now. And so upon leaving home at 18 to pursue education and to just pursue career, I became a recipient of Medicaid. And Medicaid literally provides for my day-to-day living. So it is what allows me to get out of bed every day. It's what allows me to go to work every day and be a contributing member of society, actually. Just the opportunity to pursue the things that I'm passionate about. About 10 years ago, I left kind of the area that I grew up in to move to Washington, D.C. for a job. And I didn't really know all of the nuances of what it would look like to live independently, to have the care that I needed. And thankfully, the Maryland Medicaid system stepped in. And so it allowed me to have the appropriate care, not only the appropriate care, meaning having people that come in every day to assist me, they also provide for medical supplies that I need on a day-to-day basis as well. So quite honestly, it makes all the difference in the world, Medicaid does. If it were removed, we would go back decades and decades, and that it would require likely institutionalization, which we've worked so hard, Americans in general have worked so hard to ensure is not a requirement. Medicaid allows me to live in my community, but not only to live in my community, to be a contributing member of society, and that's what I think we all deserve.
Similarly to Andrea, Medicaid allows me to live in my community, and we things like the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, we would not be able to, those pieces of legislation wouldn't matter essentially to us in a lot of ways if Medicaid stopped existing, because the only way for me, much like Andrea mentioned, to exist every day, let alone existing outside of my home and outside of an institution, hospital or nursing home, is to have the in-home care that Medicaid provides. When we were young, it helped my parents get a little bit of respite and assistance. And now I'm 33 and at the point where even though I do still live in my parents' home, they're not physically capable of providing the level of care that I still that my twin and I still require. So much like Andrea, it allows us to contribute to society in a way that everyone else takes for granted. I have been thinking about it this morning, and I spoke earlier about how much the IDEA meant in helping me get an education. And while I was talking about that, I realized that, again, that education wouldn't matter if I wasn't able to take that education and translate it into finding a way to live productively and happily in the community. Why invest in educating children with a disability? So if you're gonna start investing in us when we're children, as should be the case, of course, why would you then justify stopping that right at the point when we can take all that education and everything we've worked so hard to achieve to contribute back to society?
So let me tell you a little bit about my daughter. Her name is Caroline, and she is 7 years old. She's bright and funny, and right now she's all about the Disney Princess movies. So, you know, in a lot of ways, she's like a lot of little girls that you know that are her age. But unlike most typical girls her age, Caroline can't walk, she can't talk, use her hands, she can't sit unassisted, and she can't chew, because she has Rett syndrome, a neurological disorder that essentially interferes with her ability to control her body. I never imagined that I would have a child that would depend on us for every aspect of daily living for the rest of her life. But I also never imagined that this little person would bring so much love and so much joy into our life, and she is our sunshine. But in addition to her disability, Caroline also suffers from a long list of medical conditions. She takes 10 different medications multiple times a day. She takes medications for her seizures. She takes 4 of them, but she still has about 90 a year. She has to take medications to help her sleep, because otherwise she would only get a couple of hours of sleep each night, because Rett syndrome essentially causes insomnia because the involuntary movements never stop. She also takes medication so she doesn't vomit all the time. Before we found the right medication, she was throwing up about a dozen times a day, which was tough. And she also has, her body's pretty rigid, so she has to take medication to just help her muscles relax just a little bit. Caroline also has severe obstructive sleep apnea, which means that she stops breathing throughout the night. She essentially doesn't fully inhale and exhale properly, so she ends up retaining a high level of carbon dioxide. And so she uses a BiPAP breathing machine 12 hours a day just to do what we all take for granted, which is to breathe and to stay alive. Caroline also suffers from severe respiratory complications. So she is really susceptible to pneumonia, which is one of the leading causes of death in Rett syndrome. And to just keep her out of the ICU and just to keep her breathing, she undergoes a couple of hours of lung therapies and treatments every single day when she even has a slight cold. We amp those up to almost nonstop round the clock, and that's a lot of work. We have to try and squeeze in when we, perfectly time and when we, feed her and ourselves. But it's not something that just one person can do by themselves. So what usually happens when she's sick is that since we only have limited nursing hours a day, my husband and I will both take off from work and just care for her This is, you know, caring for her is a full-time job, but Medicaid provides us with skilled nursing services, and so this allows us to care for Caroline in her home because she needs a lot of medical assistance. It also allows my husband and me to hold jobs and to take care of our family needs. Medicaid also helps cover the cost of prescriptions and copays and treatments and medical equipment that is not covered by our insurance, and these costs usually add up to several thousand dollars a month each month. And the other thing that also was a surprise to us that we didn't know about Medicaid is that it requires monthly visits from a nurse, and it was during one of those visits that we realized that Caroline has sleep apnea, that she wasn't really breathing at night. So because of Medicaid, we're able to administer all of her medical needs at home, and she went from spending several weeks in a row in the ICU almost every time she caught a cold to just one hospitalization last year, which saves a lot of money. I looked at the bill once for just one ICU stay, and just from what I saw, I know that other costs came in months later, but just from what I saw, it was something like almost $90,000. And so having the nurses at home and having the equipment is a fraction of the cost. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. So it's only been in the past 6 months that I started to think of Caroline living past the age of 10. And that's been a huge deal in our family because we've been, you know, I know that life has no guarantees and you never know what's going to happen, but just knowing that you have a child who has a limited lifespan, because that's what you see in other Red Girls, is hard. And so you just take it day by day. And one of the ways that I've coped is just by, you know, not focusing beyond today or tomorrow even, and not really trying to imagine what will our life be like when Caroline's a teenager or hopefully an adult. But I've started to at least dream about those scenarios in a positive way, and because we want Caroline to be with us forever. Just from looking at statistics, it's clear that that's not usually the case in Rett syndrome. So anyway, not having Medicaid would be detrimental to our family financially. I don't know how we would pay for all the medical expenses. I don't know how we would be able to go to work. And, you know, at the end of the day, we want to have some semblance of a normal life. And we want to work and we want to be productive, tax-paying members of our society. And we want Caroline to be alive.
And that does it for this week's episode of Off Kilter, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm your host, Rebecca Vallis. The show is produced each week by Eliza Schultz. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Off Kilter Show. And you can find us on the airwaves on the Progressive Voices Network and the We Act Radio Network, or anytime as a podcast on iTunes. See you next week.
I want freedom. Freedom. Where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the mouth. We just trying to get freedom.